Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Students across the Bay Area are heading back to school this month, and one of the biggest issues looming in the background is what role artificial intelligence will play in the classroom. Will it help teachers teach and students learn, or will it facilitate cheating or trip up users with misinformation? We'll be discussing these questions and more later in this hour. And then we'll talk with Nina Schuyler about her new collection of short stories that put climate change front and center and include a wonderful set of characters set right here in the Bay Area. But first, let's talk coyotes. If you live here in San Francisco, you may have seen them on your daily walk or read about their unprovoked attack on a girl at a summer camp in the botanical gardens this past June, or how they surrounded and killed a dog at Baker Beach earlier this month. If any of this has you concerned, and I think a lot of people in the Bay Area are, then stay tuned. Rebecca Dimitrick, CEO of Humane Wildlife Control Incorporated, is here tonight to help us understand coyotes, why they seem to be multiplying, and most importantly, what to do if you have a run-in with one. So welcome to State of the Bay, Rebecca.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening to you. And listeners, we also want to hear from you. Do coyotes seem to be proliferating in your neighborhood? Have you or your pet had a recent interaction with a coyote? We'll be opening the phone lines early tonight, so give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on social media if you want to leave a comment there, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So, Rebecca, coyotes are wild animals, as I understand. So why are we seeing so many of them in these urban settings like in San Francisco?
Yeah, well, this is the time of year you'll see a lot more because it's pupping season. So there are going to be some, if you will, teenagers out there, and they will be dispersing. So between now and winter, you'll see some that are leaving the area and going, striking out on their own. But in general, when we see coyotes attracted to communities, urban areas, it's because of food resources. That's the bottom line. And it's very simple. And it's simple to reduce their numbers, their presence and prevalence, by reducing the food subsidies that they find in the urban environment.
So if we just did a better job putting our garbage away, we wouldn't see the coyotes. Is that the main culprit here?
Yeah, garbage. And then think about, you know, pet food being left out, fruit trees, because they are omnivorous. They eat pretty much anything that's not too much trouble. So they'll sneak around. They'll look at, you know, fruit trees, date palms, like in the downtown in Los Angeles, there's lots of date palms, garbage, compost, things like that. And also, I have to say, rodenticide bait boxes, you know, the poison boxes, there's food in there that smells, you know, attractive to animals, and it'll attract all sorts of critters, not just mice and rats.
And I gather coyotes have historically been a part of this ecosystem for a long time, but it seems like their numbers are increasing, particularly in cities like San Francisco. Is there evidence that their numbers are on the rise in recent years?
Oh, well, that's a kind of a tricky question to answer, because it's, if they get, well, first of all, coyotes, they pair bond. If they form a unit, a male and a female, a king and a queen, they'll defend a territory, a kingdom, and they won't let any other coyotes in. Now, that's a good thing. But if there's lots of food subsidies there, their kingdom doesn't have to be that big. It could be a couple square miles, 1 square mile. So if you think about it that way, you could have numerous kingdoms in an area. Whereas if we did a good job at cleaning up after ourselves and not letting them have these anthropogenic or human-related food sources, then think of it this way, though, the king and the queen would have to expand their kingdom and push other coyotes out, and that's going to reduce their overall presence, the prevalence, the number of them, the density of the population in the environment. We need to do a better job. They mirror our behavior.
And I gather coyotes have been around for a long time. I know they're very central to a lot of Native American, Native Californian lore and stories and creation myths. And is it the case that we've sort of moved into their environment, or is it that they are encroaching into ours now and creating some of these incidents that we've been reading about?
Well, I think it's more that we're luring them in. we're manipulating their behavior by our behavior, bad behavior, garbage, compost, dog food, cats being left out. That's a no-no. So it's more not that they are, they've always been here. So, but they're coming in closer. They're tolerating our presence more because they get rewarded for it. It all comes down to us.
We're speaking with Rebecca Dimitrick, CEO of Humane Wildlife Control Incorporated, about coyotes in the San Francisco Bay Area. And Rebecca, you just mentioned leaving cats out. I just described in the introduction about number of small pets, that a small dog that was killed on Baker Beach, but also the June incident where a coyote bit a girl in the botanical gardens a few years ago. There was an incident in the East Bay in the town of Moraga where someone was bit by a coyote. So how common is it for coyotes to attack humans who aren't with a pet? So not just pets, but humans are out by themselves.
Yeah, it's not. It's very, very rare. And there's so much to this, and I hope that more people will come to our meeting on Wednesday and find out much more, because there's such a short time to do this. But coyotes have a very unique social structure, and they're protective of their family, their territory, mostly against dogs. But yeah, there are times, I don't know the details around the child being bitten, what might have led up to it. But as far as dogs, if I may talk about that for a second, coyotes don't see dogs as prey, as food, as much as they do competition for food resources or a threat to their pups or their family members. And that's when you're going to have these interactions happen where they'll follow people, they'll escort people walking dogs. Has nothing to do with the person, has nothing to do with being predatory in nature. It's that they're wanting to escort the dog away from their family or away from their pups or food resource. That's what we're seeing. That is probably what happened on Baker Beach. And I'm sorry, I can't speak too much about the child being bitten because I don't know the coyote's behavior that led up to it.
Well, I understand from that attack that there weren't any young pups involved. I mean, is that a sign that coyotes are becoming more aggressive in some cases?
No, they are not. They always fear us. They always have a wariness about us. They want to avoid us. But again, going back to that, we can manipulate them. When people feed them, when they leave pet food out and they get comfortable coming close to humans, that's a problem. I don't know what happened at the park, so I can't speak on that. But it's very, very rare for someone to be bitten by a coyote.
And Rebecca, you mentioned a meeting on Wednesday night. Can you talk a bit more about what that is for listeners?
Yeah, thanks. August 21st, 6:30 p.m. We're having a meeting. It's on Zoom, so everybody's welcome to come. And it'll be a panel of folks after our presentation. We look forward to having a lot of questions, talking about different things in the Bay Area. It's about living with coyotes in the Bay Area. We'll have panelists joining us from the San Francisco Animal Care and Control, San Francisco Recreation and Parks, and the Presidio Trust.
And we've got a link up on our website on the post for the show. So if anyone wants to get more information, do visit our State of the Bay webpage. So thank you for more details on that Wednesday gathering. So if listeners are out and about and they run into a coyote, what do you recommend that they do? Let's say they're with a pet, and then what do they do if they're without a pet?
Yeah, with a pet, with a dog, let's say if you're out on a walk with a dog and you're in a kingdom where there's a male and female protecting their kingdom, they're going to be really reactive to dogs if they have pups nearby. So they'll try and escort you. They'll follow you. Hazing, which is where you try and be big and loud and scare the coyote away. Sometimes that doesn't work when you're accompanied by a dog because they're focused on the dog. They want the dog to get out of there. So what we recommend is for you to just move out of that area and then report it to authorities. Hopefully there's a system in place. In different municipalities, they have a system where you can report it and somebody else can go out and haze appropriately. But always, always, always have your dog on a leash and a 6-foot leash, not these extend the leashes. Always pay attention. Look around you. You know, be aware of your surroundings and look behind you and see. If you're letting your dog out at night in your yard and you know that there's coyotes around, go outside first. Step outside, make some noise, make your presence known, and then let your dog out. But don't leave little pets unattended, little dogs or cats unattended outside ever.
And Rebecca, we have a question from a listener, Wendy, who asked, do coyotes have any predators?
Oh, that's a good question. Mountain lions, and then I guess if you want to consider humans predators, but they consider, as all wild animals do, they consider us predators, and they fear us enough to move away from us. So coyotes have not lost their fear of humans. We can always get them to move away from us if we act appropriately.
And of course, you know, many people live in an urban environment tend to be afraid of seeing a wild animal like a coyote. But can you talk about some of the benefits that coyote might bring to our ecosystem and our environment here in San Francisco?
Yeah, they're wonderful. They eat mostly small rodents. So gophers, rats, mice, voles, all the things you don't want. In some other areas, they'll eat goose eggs, and they do keep the deer population in check. They're excellent, and they're so, you know, if we can get around this, the animus, the hatred, if somebody's lost a pet or they just, you know, they don't want these animals here, they're incredible. The social structure that they have, and they're monogamous when they pair up, that's for life. And, you know, there's a joke like, oh, you're such a dog, right? This is a wild dog, a canid, that is monogamous. They mate for life until death do they part. And that's pretty phenomenal.
Well, you mentioned that they take out deer. My mom actually just relayed a story where her dog was confronted by a coyote, but then a deer actually showed up and chased the coyote off. So does that happen, or are they actually usually turning the tables on deer and hunting deer?
No, that's a perfect example. The deer hazed the coyote.
Huh. Well, it's good to know that they're that skittish. It bodes well for, you know, pets and humans. We got to let you go in just a minute, but any last information you want to share with listeners before we do?
Just really start with your home and your backyard and then your neighborhood, and just make sure that you're not luring coyotes into your neck of the woods.
All right. Well, if you didn't know all this about coyotes, you do now. I want to thank you, Rebecca Dimitrick, local coyote expert and CEO of Humane Wildlife Control Incorporated, for joining us and talking to us about coyotes and what to do if and when we run into one.
Great. Thank you so much. Good night.
Good night. And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll be talking about the benefits and risks to using artificial intelligence in classrooms. That's right after the break, so stay with us.
This week on The Arts, yet another homage to Peter Schickele, also known as PDQ Bach, who passed away in January of 2024. You'll hear The Stoned Guest, a satirical half-act opera, the title which borrows heavily from the commendatory statue in Mozart's Don Giovanni, with a sousance of Bizet's Carmen thrown in for good measure. I'm David LaTulipe. Join me for a lighthearted On the Arts Wednesday at 4.
Hi, I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call. Join us on Mondays at 7 p.m. for an ongoing series on Project 2025. This Heritage Foundation-led plan lays out an agenda to transform the country into a Christian nation. Project 2025 would dismantle the administrative state and ensure arch-conservative rule for decades to come. It would affect all aspects of life and would be implemented by expanding presidential powers and eliminating federal agencies. Join us on Mondays at 7 p.m. here on KALW.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Ever since bursting onto the scene 2 years ago, ChatGPT and other forms of generative AI or artificial intelligence have threatened to uproot pretty much every aspect of our lives. Now, broadly speaking, for those not familiar with AI, the technology allows machines to execute tasks that have traditionally required human intelligence, but AI-powered programs and devices can make decisions, solve problems, understand language, and learn from unstructured data. Now, as many of us find ways to integrate these tools into our work and lives by doing things like drafting emails or even planning vacations, there's one place where the use of these technologies is still evolving and particularly controversial, and that's in the classroom. As part of our Back to School series, we wanted to get a sense of how teachers and students are using AI currently, and we want to understand the potential benefits and pitfalls of these technologies and discuss where we might go from here. So to do that, we're really pleased to be joined tonight by a great panel of guests. First, we have Gwen Hornig, an eighth grade English and drama teacher at Black Pine Circle School in Berkeley. Welcome, Gwen.
Hi, thank you so much.
And we have Dan Schwartz, the I. James Quillen Dean and Normalini and Olivier Professor of Educational Technology at the Stanford Graduate School of Education. Dan, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you. Good evening.
And last but definitely not least, we have Victoria Thorpe, who is a lecturer in the English department at San Jose State University, where she teaches first year writing. And she's also an esteemed former producer for our show. So welcome back to State of the Bay, Victoria.
Thank you. Really happy to be here.
Well, it's great to have all three of you. And we do want you, our listeners, to be a part of this conversation. So for teachers and students, we want to hear from you. How are you using AI? And do you feel like it's helping or hurting the learning process? And for parents, we'd love to know what questions or concerns you might have about this new technology, particularly given that our students are essentially guinea pigs now for how AI will be used in the schools, for better or for worse. So you can give us a call. We are at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on social media if you want to post any questions or comments or stories there. And you can also email us with the same at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So let me start first just by asking both of the teachers who have joined us here how you're both approaching student use of AI. And Gwen, let me start with you. Are you giving assignments where students are allowed or even expected to use AI?
I have yet to give an assignment where students are expected to use AI. I think the extent to which we've used it in my classroom has been for just a group exploration of what it is and what it's capable of, and exploring ways that it could potentially be used in assignments. And I'd say those were all things that we did last year in my class. And my anticipation going into this year is to think more constructively about assignments that would ask students to use it and engage with it as a tool. And I'm still working through what exactly that would look like, but really trying to embrace this mindset of like, this is a thing that exists now in our world and in education, and how can I reframe it as a tool for my students and engage with it that way.
And Gwen, you're talking about how you're still figuring this out. How are you figuring this out? Are you talking to fellow teachers? Are there resources out there that you're consulting? How are you kind of doing your thinking and learning on this subject?
I definitely talk with my colleagues a lot of our conversations are around how we're seeing it show up and how we've seen students use it, even when they're not supposed to use it. So that would be one way. I'm also playing around with it myself, like just getting on ChatGPT and just like seeing what it can do, and also and using it as a resource for myself in terms of generating ideas for writing prompts, generating like unpunctuated paragraphs for grammar instruction. And then also reading about it. I attended a lecture about AI and education earlier this summer, which was really interesting, and debriefed it with a group of teachers. Just trying to keep the dialogue open, because I feel like it's an ever changing landscape, and I feel like we as teachers are already behind.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you had to use some of your summer to think through this changing technology here. Let me turn to Victoria. You teach at a college. What approach are you taking with the use of AI and your students and your teaching?
Yeah, I'm pretty similar to Gwen. Only thing is I teach first year writing. San Jose State has a 2-semester writing requirement for all incoming students. And so I'm basically redoing the curriculum in both of those classes to incorporate a very strong acknowledgement and integration of AI into some of the writing processes. But the other thing I'm doing is a big step back at the beginning of the semester to really give the students a deep dive into some of the ethics around about ChatGPT and the use of AI, how it is biased, showing them how it's biased, showing them how information that it retrieves and uses can be incorrect, and helping them understand like that it isn't just a thing you just use and you don't have any thought about it, that you really have to understand what its limitations are, what it's doing, and to be aware of some of the things that can come up. Like if you ask ChatGPT to create a picture or write an essay about a doctor, it's almost always going to show a man. It'll write about a person with a male pronoun. So just little things like that, that the students just need to understand. That I want them to understand. The other thing I'm going to do is I'm having them, their first assignment is they have to write a personal ethical statement about their own use of AI in the classroom. Because my feeling is I can only police it so far. And I want them to understand that they're like at the bleeding edge of, I like how you said guinea pigs, because they truly are the guinea pigs that are being kind of put through this change of technology and change of world in real time without any guardrails around it, without a lot of conversation about what it's going to mean for them. And I have this very strong desire to have them understand that they've now, like we as human beings have to maintain our humanity in all of this, and what's our value add, and how do we engage with all these technologies while holding on to what we have and our stories, our voice, our opinions. That's what differentiates us from AI. So they're going to write a personal ethical statement, sort of making their own commitment to that with it, and how they're going to approach it this semester. And then this is the last thing I do. I did this last year, but I'm going to do it even more this year, is at the end of every major assignment, they write a reflection essay and they have to self-report how they've used AI, how they used AI and help in writing the assignment. And then when I look at it, I mean, you can still detect it to some extent. It's getting better and better, and you can ask it to make a few mistakes. You can ask it to write like an eighth grader. I mean, compared to where it was 2 years ago, it's harder and harder to see it, but there's still this robotic kind of generic aspect to it that you can see. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be looking out for that. If the students say they don't use it and I see it, that's like a big red flag and there's going to be consequences around that. But I want them to use it, and we're going to be learning how to use it as a tool. So sorry, that was a long answer, but
No. It's really fascinating to hear how both of you are really confronting this head on and really trying to adapt to the technology as opposed to, you know, kind of trying to put our heads in the sand and pretend this doesn't exist and hope students aren't cheating when they're using it. But Dan, Let me turn to you, because you've got a bit of a bigger picture here, because given that you work with a lot of different educators, do you get the sense that there is starting to be a sort of consensus best approach to introduce and use AI in academic settings?
So, you know, an interesting fact, I think it's a fact, is there's a bunch of surveys that go out. And at the end of last year, they sort of all came back the same, that about 60% of high school teachers or K-12 teachers are using generative AI, whereas about 30% of students are. But if you go to higher education, it flip-flops. 30% of the faculty are using generative AI, where 60% of the students are. So I find that interesting to think about, the students in college are sort of saying, I need to use these tools. I'm going to use them in the rest of my life. I'm going to use them now. Pre-K to 12, they don't know yet. So it's important to teach them how to use these tools. What you're hearing about are people who are using, very effective teachers who are figuring out how to use ChatGPT to teach. And there's a lot of interesting experiments on this. But at the same time, there's a lot of companies that are now starting to produce AI tools for teachers and students. And if you look at those tools, for the most part, they're trying to automate what people already do, rather than trying to figure out what are new ways to teach, what are new things people should learn. Given this, the future with AI. So I worry a little bit that we're going to settle on what's called a local optima, something that schools can readily adopt, but in the end may get in the way of the changes that are possible.
Mm-hmm. And Dan, when you say teachers are using AI, do you mean that they're generating lesson plans? How are they using AI from the teaching perspective?
Generate lesson plans. Automated grading is a good one. There's a nice ethical question there. if you do AI to grade papers, but you don't let the students use AI to make it, well, who's who in that situation? You know, some of the more exciting applications, I think, are where teachers are figuring out how to use it to manage project-based learning. So project-based learning is really complicated because maybe every student has a different project. You're a middle school teacher with 120 students, and the AI can help manage that, can help track what the students are doing, help customize for each kid. So I think that's kind of an exciting application. Writing IEPs. So if you have a child with special needs, they need a special program that has a lot of descriptions and goals, and the AI helps people do that. So just about anything you can think of where you might imagine automating it, it can do it.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, we do think mostly about students using it, but the idea that teachers are taking advantage of these tools as well, I think, is probably pretty eye-opening for a lot of people, though I suppose not surprising. And if you're just joining us, this is Ethan Elkind. And this is State of the Bay. We're talking about the use of artificial intelligence in schools. Now that it's back to school month, it seems to be happening earlier and earlier in California. Still feels like summer to me. But we're joined by Gwen Hornig, eighth grade English and drama teacher at Black Pine Circle School in Berkeley. Dan Schwartz, who you just heard, the I. James Quillen Dean and Normalini and Olivier, professor of educational technology at Stanford Graduate School of Education, and Victoria Thorpe, lecturer in the English department at San Jose State. And we do want to hear from you as well, teachers and students. If you have an AI story, if you have an approach with AI, or a worry about how AI is possibly hurting the learning process, or a parent, if you have questions or concerns, you can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or send us a message on social media, or you can email us at stateofthebay@klw.org. But we have a clip, an audio clip from a student about how he is using AI for his schoolwork. This is a clip we got earlier this week. So let's take a listen here.
I'm a rising senior in San Francisco, and I use AI in my computer science class, as our teacher advises us to use it when we have issues debugging our code or when we're struggling with one specific aspect of our code. We're encouraged to use AI to solve it and then see how the AI does it to learn how to do it ourselves.
So that was a rising senior in San Francisco, as I mentioned, and that sounds like a pretty reasonable use. But Dan, I'm wondering, how can a teacher be sure the student actually goes the extra step to make sure that he or she understands what the AI has actually done? I mean, is a teacher here letting the AI do work that the teachers should be doing or the students should be doing?
Well, part of that's a very deep question about who should be doing what. You know, so I teach students to use AI to write essays. Do I give them a test where I let them use the AI, or do I think that's cheating? So very, very profound questions there. You know, I think I'd like to hear Victoria's response to this, but I think students need policies for the use of this. And the policy that I'm thinking about is that you need to explain the reasoning, the composition choices, and the facts that are in whatever you produce. Mm-hmm. So if you want to check, does the student know, go ask them.
Mm-hmm. So, Dan, thank you for referring to Victoria here. So, Victoria, I do want to get your take on this as well. What do you make of that student using AI in that way to essentially check work?
I think that's exactly the sort of thing AI should be used for. I mean, and I think it's a good way to check work. I think that Dan brings up a great point. You can always find out from a student if they actually know, you know, and then one of the things I thought I was struck by what he said is, and my students have said this, like, sometimes I just don't know what it's supposed to look like. I don't know exactly what you're asking for. I don't know where it's going. And AI can kind of give them some picture of that. AI can go like, oh, here's where your problems are. And that prevents the student from sitting at home and giving up, procrastinating, never finishing the work, and falling behind because they're just overwhelmed. So my students have said, you know, oh, you want me to write a rhetorical analysis? Even though I've gone over it a million times in class and I've shown them examples, of course, they go home and they're like, what was all that? And then they can go on AI, they can go to ChatGPT, and ChatGPT can churn out a really simple rhetorical analysis. And they're like, oh, okay, this is what she's looking for. So I think some things like that are pretty profound. I mean, I think about it like a calculator, honestly. Like, I'm not a math teacher, But I can only imagine when calculators came online that math teachers were just losing their minds. And they had to really change how they taught, because all of a sudden computation was less important when you could move up to higher level thinking if you didn't have to spend all your time adding up giant numbers. So I think we're all kind of in that mode right now. Like, what can we allow students to do with AI to allow them the higher order thinking? But how do we make sure they still learn it?
Big change from the abacus to the calculator. Maybe we're doing something similar here that you all have to juggle. And Victoria, let me stay with you. So according to a recent report by a strategy consulting firm, Titan Partners, teachers are turning to AI tools and platforms that Dan just referenced, such as ChatGPT, Writable, Grammarly, Essay Grader, all to assist with grading papers, writing feedback, developing lesson plans, creating assignments. So Victoria, just to start with you on this, are you using AI to help with these types of tasks as a teacher?
Yeah, I mean, I'm similar to what Gwen was saying. Like, I'm just using it to sort of brainstorm. Like, okay, because I'm changing my curriculum a lot this semester, another thing that we're all at San Jose State working on in the composition program is integrating multimodal composition as opposed to just only text composition. So I'm changing a lot of my assignments, or several of my assignments in each one of my classes, into that. So that's all new for me. So I'm using ChatGPT to like churn out a lesson plan. What does this look like? And then I look at it, I'm like, oh, okay, there's bare bones things here that are helpful, sequencing things that are helpful for me to see. So yeah, I think things like that are really helpful, honestly, for all of us. But it's not like that's my lesson plan, you know, because that's not me and that's not how I teach.
It's augmenting what you're already doing.
Yeah.
And Gwen, let me ask you about your experience too. Middle school teachers are, of course, notoriously overworked. How have you been integrating AI tools to streamline the tasks that you have on your plate?
I guess I'll start off by saying I'm definitely an AI skeptic and super AI resistant in terms of like my own usage. When I talk about it in terms of like facing it head on with my students, it's doing it because I know that it's a tool they need to learn. And I will say for me personally, I enjoy kind of the slog of the slow process. And so as much as like I have experimented with it to generate, you know, writing prompts and unpunctuated paragraphs for grammar work, as I mentioned before. But I think I always have this moment afterwards of like, oh, but was that like I didn't use part of my thinking, like the machine did it for me. And so I think I'm definitely like coming up against my own like internal moral struggle over like what feels okay for me. And then how does that translate to the way that I am talking about this in the classroom with my students and moderating that internal tension with the reality of where we are. So it's not a super helpful answer to the question for teachers ways to use it, but.
No, it's a good data point. I think there's a diversity of teacher approaches to this. And Dan, to turn to you on this, what are you seeing in terms of how teachers are embracing or not AI? What are some of the risks about them doing so?
Slightly two different questions. Sorry, I'm an academic. I have to say, I'm sorry. Those are two questions. So a lot of people are using it to solve the blank page problem, right? You sit down, you got to get started. You got to get started with a lesson plan. You got to get started with an essay. You use these things to help you come up with some ideas. You then write it, right? And then you give it back to the machine to edit, and it takes out the parts you like, so you stick them back in. I think this is a very typical cycle. Some of the risks, I don't know. We kind of missed the boat on social media. We forgot that people need to know something to actually use the internet. So I worry a little bit about that in the AI space, that we'll miss the boat, you know, and just assume that people use these tools and all these tools will be benign.
So we have an email from a listener who writes, I am a former teacher as well as the parent of a second grade boy. My son has proven to be very good at math. He's quick to pick up concepts, understands them easily, but if I had the choice of having him sitting at a computer doing problems that would help him get further ahead, or sitting in regular math class with his peers and teacher, I'd opt to keep him in class. To me, that social interaction and the social emotional aspect of learning is more important than having him jump ahead. And Dan, curious if you have a reaction to that. Is there a trade-off here between social interaction and the use of these AI tools?
Oh, they're both good. You know, it's not for me to prescribe at that level. You know, there are places where there are schools where the first 3 hours of the day, the kids are in front of computers learning reading, writing, math, history, social studies. And that's all they do. There's no teacher in the room. And then the remaining 5 hours, they do enrichment activities. Some kids and some parents just love this. I don't know what I think about it. It seems to be a little mechanical, short on social. But, you know, they're okay with it. I'm not going to get in their way.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there's some people who believe that all learning is purely social. And, you know, that's good for them. I actually learn by reading books by myself. So maybe that's too extreme. So I appreciate that point of view. You know, I think that's a decision. It's a little bit like your kid's cell phone use. How much is too much?
Yeah, different learning styles and different approaches. Gwen Hornig, you're an 8th grade English and drama teacher. That's an age where social interaction can be very perilous, but also pretty necessary, you know, as people, you know, really haven't developed their own lives, you know, as much outside of school. What do you think about that social interaction versus technology potential trade-off?
I mean, I feel like looking at these trade-offs is so integral to having this conversation. And I come from the perspective of school is a social education just as much as it is an academic education. And I think back to the impact that distance learning had on our students and what it felt like to come back to campus. And I was teaching 6th grade at the time and being with these students who didn't know how to really interact and deal with social conflict because they'd been so isolated and hadn't been faced with the, you know, quote unquote normal interactions and building those muscles of navigating conflicts and tough moments. And so when I think about the responsibility that schools have to our students and thinking about the balance of, you know, integrating the personalized learning that perhaps AI has the capacity to provide for our students versus the value of sitting in a group in a classroom with a teacher and collaborating and problem solving together. I really think that schools have a responsibility to really think critically about that balance and to think about how much time our students are already spending on screens unmoderated to a degree and how we can provide a different experience at school. Cool. And so I would say that parent perspective is actually really refreshing to hear.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, it's a vote in confidence there. So if you're just tuning in, this is State of the Bay on KALW San Francisco Bay Area 91.7 FM. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about the use of artificial intelligence in schools for Back to School Month here in August. We're joined by Gwen Hornig, an 8th grade English and drama teacher at Black Pine Circle School in Berkeley. Also Dan Schwartz, who is the I. James Quillen Dean and Nomalini and Olivia Professor of Educational Technology at Stanford Graduate School of Education, and Victoria Thorpe, lecturer in the English Department at San Jose State University, where she teaches first-year writing. And we want to hear from you, our listeners, especially students. If you're using AI to help with your schoolwork, and teachers, if you found a way to integrate AI into your lessons, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And we have an email in from Rob, who writes, OpenAI has mentioned that they have a tool that can prevent student cheating that has been ready for release for some time, but they haven't released it. What are your thoughts about tools to help instructors identify essays that are wholly generated with AI versus just edited? And Victoria, maybe I'll start with you on that, given that you're teaching first year writing. What are some of the ways that you're trying to detect cheating? And what do you see, just to add in the second question, as Dan called me out on for asking two questions at once, what are some of the other risks that you might be coming across with AI, you know, beyond just cheating on writing assignments?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. I want to just quickly say, I do think the use of AI and technology is a both and in the classroom, because students can have really interesting conversations when they themselves look at AI generated text and talk about it and understand what is it about that isn't human, isn't value added, doesn't have the personal story opinions that make writing really good. But to answer your question, yeah, I was as a teacher quite emotional when I saw the story about how OpenAI was holding back that feature. that you're mentioning, because they polled their users and users said that they would stop, 30% of their users or some percentage said they would stop using ChatGPT and switch to another program if that detection software was integrated into the app or whatever, you know, the program. And that, you know, there's people within the company who would like to get it released, but from a financial point of view, they haven't. So I do think we're caught in the crosshairs of this, sort of like Dan was saying, like, we have a company that's profit driven whose products are going to really change how we do everything. And I'm not just talking about school right now. It's everything. That's a story for a different show probably. But to answer your question about it, I would really appreciate that, honestly. And I think that's why I'm trying to get from this policing mode to, like, we got to use it as a tool and let's figure out how to personally, we all have to make our personal commitment to what are our boundaries for using it. I really like what Gwen said. When I generated a lesson plan, like, I am a struggler. I write with a pencil and on my piece of paper. I have textbooks that I'm using in class. I use the paper ones. Like, I'm so old school, but I am trying to see the benefit of some of these generative things for my own thinking. Like, oh, this is interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way. And that's helpful. So, but I just want to add one other thing I'm trying to talk to my students about, because the college students are very, very focused. And one of their big things is climate change. They're very worried about climate change with good reason. But AI uses an absolute mountain of energy. So I want that to be part of their ethical statement. Like, don't just go on ChatGPT for the hell of it and, excuse me, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, for the heck of it and just generate stuff just for fun. Because every time you do that, that is firing up this massive, gigantic engine. So those are all.
That is very true. They're a huge, huge energy suck. And we've seen massive spikes in electricity demand because of these AI servers. That's absolutely true. But I appreciate that perspective. We just have a couple of minutes left. And Dan, I want to ask you about just what's next here on the AI front in the classroom. Are we going to get to the point where we're going to have a strong sense about what's working and what's not? When are we going to kind of be able to, you know, wrap our heads around the technology and feel confident about how we're moving forward with it in the classroom?
Let's see. So first, on the cheating question, I can't resist. Sorry.
Okay.
A big challenge is defining what counts as cheating now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a big issue. So, you know, your word processor checks your grammar and your spelling. Is that cheating? It is AI. Very few people just put the problem in whole scale and say, do it for me. Right. I think maybe there's a few people who cheat like that. That's sort of not what's happening. So the future, it's really moving fast. What I hope to see being developed, but maybe out of universities rather than companies, is the ability to use the AI to say, create simulations. So I'm a student in a science class and I tell the computer to make a simulation of wolves, sheep. Let's make it coyotes, so it's relevant. Coyotes, sheep, and grass in the predatory eating relationships. And then the computer creates this program, and then I start to edit it to make sure that it's actually capturing the right relations. This would be something very different than the largely text-based kinds of interactions we're seeing, or the ones where I tell it to draw a picture and it does it. So it's going to be able to, I'm going to be able to tell it to make interactive stuff. And I think that's, it's going to kind of change what we're asking students to do, how we're going to grade it, how we think about what it is they need.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one prediction.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. There's so much more that we can discuss, and we'll have to have you all back on for a round two, maybe as we're heading into school next year or maybe leaving the school year this year. But I just want to thank you all so much for joining us. That was Dan Schwartz, Dean of Stanford's Graduate School of Education, Gwen Hornig, 8th grade English and drama teacher at Berkeley's Black Pine Circle School, and Victoria Thorpe, writing instructor at San Jose State University. Thank you all, and good luck with the school year ahead to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up after the break, we're going to hear guest host Ann Harper interview local author Nina Schuyler about her new short story collection. We'll be right back.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11.
Project 2025 is the conservative blueprint made for a Trump presidency, and analysts say its immigration policy is heavily inspired by one state.
It's looking at how to go directly at California and the so-called sanctuaries it's created for various communities here.
What immigration under Project 2025 looks like. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
In her new short story collection, In This Ravishing World, Nina Schuyler introduces her readers to an unforgettable cast of characters who struggle to shed a light on the way the climate crisis is impacting us all. The book won the W.S. Porter Prize for short story collections and the Prism Prize for climate literature. And I'm so pleased that Nina is able to join us tonight. Nina Schuyler, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
We're so happy to have you here with us to talk about this really wonderful new collection of stories. Before we dive into the conversation, can I ask you to read a passage from the book? It talks about the night.
Night knows how to swallow things, too. I'm envious of night, how it seeps in like a leaky black pen bleeding on a white shirt, snatching the edges, smearing where one thing begins and another thing ends. Night and I, we are the oldest of friends, all the way back to the beginning. It moves up from the ground, fusing trees, bushes, and bodies. As it inks the sky, night reveals a great truth. Edges, boundaries, separation, they exist, but the fragmentation is contained in something bigger, and that is wholeness.
That's such a beautiful passage. And so to clarify for our listeners, can you talk about who is narrating that section?
That section, I anthropomorphize nature. So the voice of nature is woven in and out of the collection as a first-person voice, commenting on humanity, the world, the state of things, pleading, arguing, enjoying, seeking out beauty, all this whole range of voice.
That certainly adds a profound element to the book. Can you talk about how you decided to do that?
Yeah, it was a real struggle, I have to say, coming up with the idea. I was listening to the news, and it was after one of the many California wildfires when Governor Gavin Newsom said, he was in this burned out forest, the ground was black, there were no trees anywhere. And he said, nature is talking. And then my imagination leaped. I said, well, what could it possibly be saying? I want to figure it out. And so I got busy inventing the voice. Now, it is a human trying to imagine nature. When you're crossing boundaries that way and trying to do the imaginative bridge into another being, it takes all of your imagination to figure it out. So in the beginning, the voice was enraged. And then I said, wait a minute, humanity, people, readers are never going to listen to a voice that's yelling all the time. I have to think more deeply. And that had led me down a road of just, wait a minute, it has compassion. And it too has felt full of despair and joy, that whole spectrum of emotion. So I started writing that voice as well. And then the profound thing I thought about is that nature has such a different sense of time rather than right. humans.
Right.
And so that led me to exploring the concept of deep time, which is a John McPhee term going back to 4.5 billion years ago. So I had to really back away and start the voice over once I figured out time.
And that's one of many voices that you have in the collection. The first story features Eleanor, who's an environmental economist who has very conflicted feelings upon learning that she's just won the Goldman Award, which is a prestigious environmental award. Why did you choose to open the collection with Eleanor's story?
I have several friends that are in the environmental movement and who are environmental scientists, and we take walks in the hills to try to just think through things. And I keep hearing how much despair there is in the environmental world. They even have a term for it now, eco or eco-grief. And I thought it was fascinating, and I have suffered from it as well. So just trying to think through and really go deep into that grief. And imagine if you've devoted your life to trying to save the planet. She's an environmental economist trying to convince companies to internalize externalized costs. And they do for a while, and then they stop doing it, and back and forth. Just imagining the heavy burden that those on the front line must carry as they watch the degradation of the world happen.
Yeah, it reminded me of a saying in the environmental community, which is our wins are always temporary and our losses are permanent. And I felt her despair. So had you felt that same frustration? Is that what motivated you to write this collection?
Yes, I have felt that. I think everybody's felt that if they're half paying attention, and they might not call it the climate crisis. I know some people don't want to use that term, or they don't believe in it, but they've seen the weather change. They've experienced dry crops, can't grow anything, trying to deal with water. And so living in California, we've had one wildfire after another, as well as atmospheric rivers with flooding. I remember after one wildfire, my young boy wanted to go out and play basketball, but the air quality was so bad. It's in that brick red zone. But he's a boy. He had to go out. So I scrounged around and got an N95 mask. And this was before the pandemic, and took him out. Well, he lasted 15, 20 minutes before he was coughing and couldn't do it. It's like, is this the future? Is this it? So that got me, what do I have? What can I do? As a writer, it seemed like, well, maybe I start writing. Mm-hmm. That was the first kind of inspiration, is watching my son struggle to play basketball in the midst of a wildfire smoke.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of boys, another special character in this collection is Lincoln. Can you describe him for our listeners?
Well, Lincoln, the one thing, as I was thinking about this, we talk a lot about income disparity, but we don't talk about nature disparity. And if you look around the Bay Area, those areas that are not wealthy have very little, if any, nature. And Lincoln is 13 years old and lives kind of in urban blight. And he loves flowers and he loves green and he loves trees. So he goes running at night to find free stuff. You know, people put stuff on the sidewalk all the time with free signs. At the same time, he runs up to Pacific Heights to look at nature and just see all the variety of trees and flowers and bushes, and tries to bring it back to his neighborhood.
Your stories are all set in the Bay Area, and for those of us that live here, it's really fun to recognize some of the places that your characters live and visit. But can you talk about also how the Bay Area plays a role?
I think another big inspiration for me was the immense beauty that's in the Bay Area. I'm over in the Point Reyes, Fairfax area, and it's so stunningly beautiful. You just step outside, you're on dirt trails and heading up in the rolling hills. I hear coyotes at night, wild turkeys, and the Golden Gate Bridge and the vistas were drenched in this beauty. So the landscape was also an inspiration because my environmental scientist friends say that the trees are suffering here because of the drought. I mean, they look healthy, but they are suffering. And now and then during a storm, one will come down. So I just kind of let my mind spin. What if we lost all the trees? What if we don't do anything? And where would that natural beauty go? The setting also provided new characters for the book because we're also a tech hub. And so there's a couple characters in the book that represent a little bit of that industry. And it also captures the zeitgeist of how everybody's glued to a screen these days. And so how much does nature play a role in these lives if all you're doing is coding or looking at a phone or your computer screen at all times? And it's ironic to me that often the screensaver's screen is nature. It's like, okay, that's the glimpse you got. So that's in the book.
Right, right. Well, we've talked about Eleanor, the first character that you open with in your book, and she suffers some of the emotional and physical struggles that happen as we grow old. Did you intend to draw parallels between her aging and the planet degrading?
Yeah. So I forgot the exact sentence, but there's this sentence in there that's like, I knew I would age and the body would go through its aging process, its decay, but I didn't know it would happen simultaneously to the earth suffering and suffering destruction as well. And to have those parallel lines going on. It amplifies her grief. And then as you go through the book, I don't want to give the ending away, but there's a nod to youth. So there's a conversation between the beginning and the end and that youthful energy.
Whoa. Well, it's a powerful collection of stories. Thank you so much for sharing them with us. Nina Schuyler is the author of the short story collection In This Ravishing World. Thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay, Nina.
Thank you so much. A real pleasure.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 when San Francisco City Attorney David Chu will join us to discuss his lawsuit against websites that allow users to create non-consensual deepfake pornography. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen and you never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. You can email us anytime at stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. And finally, I want to give a shout out to the staff at the San Francisco Unified School District, as school was back in session today. So good luck to staff, students, teachers. Emergence is coming up next. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.